Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hi everyone and welcome to Lush Tums the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today we're joined by Lindsay Hookway. Lindsay is an experienced paediatric nurse and children's public health nurse, lactation consultant and co-founder and clinical director of the Holistic Sleep Coaching Program. She's also the author of three books, Holistic Sleep Coaching, Let's Talk About Your New Family's Sleep and Still Awake, Responsive Sleep Tools for Toddlers to Tweens. A passionate believer in gentle and responsive parenting that never compromises infant mental health or feeding, Lindsay works to educate professionals and families about strategies that are protective of the parent-child bond. Her knowledge and experience supporting families with sleep without leaving infants or children to cry alone is why she is trusted by breastfeeding and gentle parenting advocates all around the world. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hi, Lindsay. It's lovely to meet you.
It's great to be here. You know, I'll talk to anybody about keeping it gentle and soft and responsive with kiddies. So thanks for inviting me.
Oh, well, I'm so glad we found your work because I do think it's, I don't know if it's a modern problem of parenting or just something that perhaps is discussed more, but that conflict between needing sleep and wanting to optimize your sleep and not compromising responding to your child in a kind and responsive way. And sometimes I feel like there's this big divide between choosing to get good sleep or choosing to be responsive to your parent. And you clearly come in saying you don't have to make that choice. You can do both. So I'm really grateful for your work. It sounds as if you've had a very busy career so far. What drew you to work as a paediatric nurse?
Well, I actually wanted to be a paediatrician. But it turns out I'm rubbish at chemistry. So I actually ended up flunking chemistry. I got a D at A level, which wasn't going to get me into med school. So I had a bit of a rethink, went on a gap year, traveled around Southeast Asia and decided that actually I really liked the idea of being a paediatric nurse instead. So I went off and trained as a peds nurse, and I did enjoy it, but I actually preferred working with healthy, well children, which is bizarre to be the nurse in the paediatric ward that actually likes the well kids and doesn't particularly want to go and do the high dependency course or the oncology course or whatever. So yeah, that's how I got into paediatric nursing.
Did you find that becoming a mother influenced your career choices?
No, I'm quite unusual actually, in that my breastfeeding passion started actually well before I had my own children. There was this one key night that changed my career, I think, and I was a fairly newly minted paediatric nurse. I was, you know, maybe 22 years old. And I admitted this little baby who was about 4 days old with jaundice. He was sort of the colour of Bart Simpson, poor little love. And I remember, you know, very little about any patient I've ever looked after. But I can remember so much about this little one. He's probably doing his A-levels now. But I remember so much about it because I remember so clearly thinking, you know, as his mother sort of waddled up the ward, you know, she'd had a rough birth and she waddled up the ward after the A&E nurse who was wheeling the baby in the little bassinet. And I just sat with her all night and helped her express milk. And I just fell in love with breastfeeding. I didn't know anything really about breastfeeding, but I kind of used a bit of common sense and a bit of bluffing it and a bit of winging. And we got through it, and we laughed, and we joked about it, and that was it. I was hooked, absolutely hooked. So actually my love of public health and my love of breast and chest feeding and being gentle and not separating parents and babies, you know, on that night, I'd had umpteen lectures about family-centered care, but it took those three night shifts looking after that little one. And I thought, actually, this is what family-centered care is about. I can't actually separate caring for this baby from caring for this mother. I need to look after her because, you know, otherwise we're not going to make this little baby better, because he's got to have milk and she's got it. And, you know, it's as simple as that.
Amazing. What type of parent did you think you'd be before you had kids? And did that change when they arrived?
Well, I suppose, you know, I suppose I confess that rather arrogantly, I assumed I would have no problems parenting, because by that point, I'd been a paediatric nurse for nearly, how old, maybe 5 years, and I'd been a health visitor for three of those years as well. And I was also training to become an IBCLC by that point. So I thought, well, to be honest, if a paediatric nurse, health visitor and nearly IBCLC can't nail this, then I don't know how more qualified I need to be in order to have a baby. And nothing could have prepared me, actually, for how unprepared I felt to raise this tiny human. No medical background was useful in those early weeks, months, or even years, actually. Nothing at all.
I think that's actually really reassuring in a sort of paradoxical way, Lindsay. Do you know what I mean?
I think the funny thing is that the more health professional parents I speak to now, the more I realise how common that particular paradox is, actually. Most people who are health professionals find it incredibly difficult to separate what they know from what they feel. And, you know, living the parenting journey is very different to supporting someone else when it's quite removed and it's sanitized, and yeah, you're not emotionally wrapped up in it all, I suppose.
For those listeners who don't know what an IBCLC is, it stands for International Board Certified Lactation Consultant, and it's the highest regarded professional qualification in breastfeeding knowledge and support. It includes 1,000 hours of clinical practice. What was your own breastfeeding journey like, and why did you decide to qualify as an IBCLC?
That was a no-brainer for me, because as soon as I fell in love with breastfeeding, you know, when I was 22, back in 2005, whenever it was, I can't even remember, it was a long time ago now, I knew that I just needed to know more about this, because as much as I, you know, got the job done with this lovely mum, and we figured it out, and you know, we untangled the breast pump and we made things happen, we made magic happen, I knew that I really didn't know enough to do that again, and I knew I'd kind of got lucky. So I just started reading more and more about it, and then I met an IBCLC, and she said that to her knowledge there were no IBCLCs who were also paediatric nurses, and I was a bit like, challenge accepted. Right, that's what I'm going to do then. And it's the beginning of a very, very long journey, which is still going on now, because I'm now doing a PhD in the area of supporting medically complex children in the paediatric setting, in terms of breastfeeding and lactation support, that is. And I just knew that I wanted to be as qualified and as experienced and as, you know, helpful as I possibly could be. So it was kind of a no-brainer to go down the IBCLC route.
Was it quite a different experience? I can kind of imagine it as if you're a driving instructor and you who's never actually driven a car. So when you actually latch your baby for the first time and you have to deal with cluster feeding and any of those things, you know, either of your babies have tongue tie or any issues feeding at all, or was it all really straightforward?
So no tongue tie, but both of them were sort of early term babies. They were both induced at 38 weeks for various reasons. We did have problems, but I think the biggest problem the first time round was I would literally have rather cut off my little toe than not exclusively breastfeed my daughter. I really meant that. It was so important to me, but it was also an immense pressure because, you know, I'd been talking about breastfeeding for a long time, and I'd taught a lot of people about breastfeeding, and I'd been supporting other parents. I thought, oh my goodness, if I can't breastfeed my own child, I don't know if I can cope with that. And so my biggest fear was that I wouldn't have enough milk, and I ended up slightly sabotaging myself by doubting my own milk supply. I had this thriving, healthy little girl in front of me, and yet I panicked so much. If she didn't feed for 2 hours, I would start panicking that my milk supply was going to vanish, even though I knew that wasn't actually possible. So I just pumped all the time, and I ended up giving myself an oversupply, and she would vomit a lot. But I didn't put the two things together. I thought that because she was vomiting a lot, she was wasting all that milk, and then, you know, I would need to pump in order to produce more milk so that I could replace what she'd just vomited. It was so ridiculous. So it was really difficult the first time. And then by the time my second baby arrived, I knew I wasn't going to be one of the, you know, 1-2% of women who really, really can't produce enough milk, because I knew by that point I'd reflected and I'd understood what I'd done the first time. I knew I actually had a tendency to oversupply, and I relaxed about it, and it was just like night and day. The second baby, feeding her, was a piece of cake. She was a different baby, of course, but I was also a different mother by that point as well.
Absolutely. Did you seek any support yourself with feeding issues?
No, because well, every single time I mentioned the vomiting, or, you know, that I was worried about my supply, the only sort of, you know, support that I was offered was, oh, have you thought about giving her a dummy, or have you thought about giving her a bottle, or why don't you just switch to formula if it's stressing you out, or have you tried sleep training, or have you tried Gaviscon, or do you want me to refer you to the paediatrician? And I was just screaming inside, going, I just know there's nothing wrong with this child. I just actually want you to tell me, well done. And actually, as a health professional and as a health visitor who made it my business to tell parents, you're just doing a great job, I was just gutted when nobody did that to me. So when I had my first baby, it was 8 months before a health professional in the clinic said, oh, you're still breastfeeding. Oh, well done you. 8 months. Nobody even said, well done. I remember the new birth visit where the health visitor came to see me, and it was just like a checklist. She said, oh, how are you feeding? Breast or bottle? Tick, tick, tick. And there was just nothing. I'd sort of proudly said, oh, she's exclusively breastfed. I was really pleased with myself. And there was just nothing. So by that point, I'd slightly lost faith in the health professionals around me. I thought, well, I don't know where I'm going to get support from, but it's not going to be you. And that, of course, is not typical of all health professionals and all health visitors. I know and love many of them, but that was just my personal experience, which wasn't helpful.
I don't think you're alone with having that sort of experience for various reasons, budgets and timing and people's own personal experiences. A lot of people don't get necessarily the specific care and attention that they need at those times, which is why I think things like breastfeeding support groups can be so crucial. I trained as a peer supporter myself over 6 years ago now, when my little girl was a baby. And that's because I really felt the value of finding a tribe that did actually boost each other on and support each other. And also that very specific breastfeeding counsellor support to help. You know, I had the classic, I'm in a lot of pain, my nipples are cracked, this is really hurting. And everyone saying, your latch is fine, your latch is fine, your latch is fine. You know, seven different professionals saying, it looks fine. And it was only when, and I knew it wasn't fine, and I knew where to go for support. So I went to the support group and, you know, within an hour, sat down with a breastfeeding counsellor. I went away virtually pain-free feeding. And I just thought, why doesn't everyone know this? It's so unfair that people really struggle for weeks and weeks and weeks without that particular support. But I then found a lovely boob group tribe that are still friends and still supporting each other as we navigate other challenges through parenthood. Did you find a tribe of new mums when you had your little one?
No, I mean, my eldest is nearly 12, and back then we didn't use Facebook in the same way, so there were no Facebook groups. It sounds mad now, doesn't it, to think that that would be the case, but it's true. So there were no online groups. I joined an NCT group before she arrived, but by about 4 weeks, all but one of them were bottle feeding, formula feeding, and it was very clear that the one remaining kind of buddy who was still breastfeeding had no intention of continuing much longer. So very quickly, I was the only one out of six who was breastfeeding, and there was no immediately local La Leche League group. My local health centre didn't have a group. There was nothing. There was just nothing. So it was me, myself and I. No real wonder I ended up with pretty significant postnatal depression, really, because I was very unsupported and felt just a bit of a wacky kind of hippie. That was kind of how I was made to feel. I was a little bit deviant for keeping my little one in my bed and breastfeeding her whenever she wanted it and not really having a schedule or anything. I was just made to feel like I was quite odd.
And how do you see trends change? You know, I had mine a little bit before you. My eldest is nearly 15 and my next one's just turned 11. So I remember those days, and I remember the schools of thought that were floating around, which were not really about attachment or responding to needs. There was a huge routine pressure. And a bit like you, actually, Lindsay, I kind of went against the grain and tried to listen to my instincts more and felt quite isolated and alone a lot of the time. But I've definitely seen over the last decade a huge sway in the pendulum. And I'd love to hear what you think about where the trends are going and why that's happened and what have we got to look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the great positive story, really, because I think you're right. When I had my eldest, it was very, I'm not going to mention the name of the books, but
I didn't mention them either on purpose.
You know the ones I mean. But they were very popular, and they were kind of touted as the answer to all my problems, and they weren't, of course. And you're right. Now, I'm amazed actually at the difference. I'm first of all so grateful for what support there is available for people. So online support, physical groups, just a lot more widespread knowledge and acceptance of infant mental health and perinatal mental health. I think we're better at looking out for new parents. I think there's a lot more awareness and understanding of the importance of attachment and responsiveness. All of that stuff is so much improved, I think, from a decade ago. So I totally agree with you. And I'm blown away, actually, by the level of people's knowledge. So even just on my Instagram page, you know, I get people, you know, popping up and asking me about co-regulation or sleep pressure. And I'm just like, wow, the information is getting out there. People are beginning to understand this stuff. And they're not just banging on about 7 till 7 or drowsy but awake or wake windows or whatever else. They're actually beginning to understand and find meaning in the science behind some of this parenting stuff.
So for those that might have just heard those two phrases for the first time on our podcast, could you give a little description on you know, sleep pressure and co-regulation?
Yeah, sure. So, well, co-regulation is just the understanding that little ones aren't particularly good at self-regulating. So we as adults have lots of strategies that we can recruit to calm ourselves down when everything gets a bit much. So we can do some mindfulness, or we can do some self-talk, or we can distract ourselves, or we can have a cup of coffee, or whatever it is we need to do. Little ones have virtually no strategies. Some little ones can put their fingers in their mouth or suck their thumbs, or they can avoid eye contact, or you know, very, very primitive strategies like that. But they really can't talk themselves down from a state of crisis. So what they need is something called co-regulation, which is, I suppose, an easy way of describing it would be that they kind of steal our calm. So we come along with our calm, regulated, reassuring, therapeutic presence, and they are comforted purely by us being there for them and holding them and loving them and supporting them and being there for them, which is why it's so important to think about self-care, because of course you can't pour from an empty cup. So you need to consider your own needs, and then you can be that calm, regulated person who can calm your own baby down.
That's so beautifully put. I used to refer to it, before I had that kind of definition to hand, that we were the walking antennae, and what we kind of projected out, they'd sort of soak up and reflect back. So if we could calm ourselves, then they would come into sync with us. So yeah, it's so lovely to hear you speak about that.
It's true. And that there was a lovely paper by Barsad and colleagues called Emotion Contagion. And it's a really lovely concept and a lovely way of putting it. But it's kind of that idea that, you know, when you walk into a room and everyone's buzzing. So I don't know, imagine going to a conference about your favorite topic, and you know that everybody else there is sold out to that topic as well. And when you walk in, you can feel the vibe, can't you? You can feel the positivity and the excitement and the energy, and it feels great, and you're immediately in a good mood. But then imagine going into a room where you know you're going to be the odd one out. Everyone's whinging or bitching about something, or they're, you know, everyone's being nasty and snarky. You immediately, in a completely opposite way, you feel that as well. And you're immediately on edge and you're tense and whatever. And basically, as humans, we have this incredible ability to sense where other people are at emotionally. And yeah, your sort of explanation of being an antenna is spot on, because that's exactly what we do. We kind of literally feel the vibe. And little ones, because they are not verbal in the same way, of course, you know, they make sounds and it's meaningful, and you know, we're not talking about that necessarily today, but they can't use language and communication in the same way. They are even more reliant, I think, on non-verbal communication, and you know, they can feel the tension in our arms, they can feel the tone of our voice, they can feel our hearts beating rapidly, they can just sense that we're in a grump or we're stressed out. And that's why often, if parents are getting really stressed out and bent out of shape about, I don't know, a baby not having a nap, one of the things that we can do as a really practical tool as parents is just almost trick our brains into thinking that we don't care, it doesn't matter, just let it go, just chill out about it. And then actually you'll calm down physically and physiologically, and your little one, rather than sensing that kind of desperation and frustration, they might just pick up on your calm It's something I talk about all the time. You can't sleep with your foot on the gas pedal. And what I mean by that is that sleep occurs in that rest and digest state. It does not occur in the fight, flight, freeze state. And you know that anyway, because if you've ever tried to go to sleep and you're stressed out, you don't actually have a particularly good sleep, or it takes you longer to go to sleep or whatever. So you can't sleep with your foot on the gas pedal. You need to think, right, instead of I need to get this child to go to sleep, think I need to get this child to calm down. And that often starts with calming yourself down first.
Absolutely. I feel like there's a lot of crossover with your suggestions in the book. I really, really love Let's Talk About Your New Family Sleep, because just as you've been saying, rather than focusing solely on what your baby is or isn't doing, it's very much looking at the whole family dynamic and how that's essential really to your baby's, what they are or are not doing. And speaking about co-regulation, that now makes complete sense. In our classes and when people come and do yoga, a lot of what we're doing is trying to help them find their calm and be able to go back into the world with that sense of peace, so that they can then give that to their families, give that to their babies. It's one of those things, we can talk about it, but until you've experienced it yourself, until you've taken those deep breaths and taken a few minutes to tune into yourself and notice the immediate effect that has on everyone around you. Yeah, if you've never tried it before, give it a go for sure. What do you wish new parents knew about normal infant sleep and perhaps life with a baby generally?
Oh, I just wish people knew that it was going to be okay. I think I would love to get a giant metaphorical rubber and rub out certain phrases. I would love to put several of them in the bin. I want to put 7 till 7 in the bin. I want to put the, mythical 2-hour midday nap in the bin. And of course, if you're listening and your little one does that, that's amazing. Don't change it. Just enjoy it. But that's not to say that everybody will get that. I'd love to put drowsy but awake in the bin. That causes so much stress. I'd love to put strict schedules in the bin. I'd love to put the idea that they don't need night feeds after 6 months in the bin. You know, I think when I was a new mum, I'd sort of been led to believe that sleep was going to be a bit of a disaster for, probably 3 or 4 months, and then it'll slowly get better, and then they should sleep through the night at 6 months. And that's what I'd been taught as a nurse and a health visitor. I'm working on that, by the way. But when 6 months came and went, and there was still no sleeping through the night in sight, or even anything remotely approaching sleeping through the night, I just began to feel disillusioned and like I'd messed something up, or there was something wrong with my daughter or with me, and that, maybe everybody else who had sleep trained and put their babies on strict schedules, maybe they were onto something, maybe that was the only way of getting some sleep. But it was not something that I was comfortable with doing, and therefore I just ended up feeling, like there was nothing that I could do. And of course there are things that you can do, and I just didn't know them at that point. And I've subsequently gone on to, learn a lot more about sleep, and thank goodness. You don't have to sleep train. I'm not promising sleeping through the night. I definitely don't want anyone to think that I'm kind of selling snake oil here. Little ones wake in the night, and I wish people just kind of knew what to expect, I suppose, had realistic expectations that sleeping through the night it's not linear. It doesn't gradually get better with time. In fact, it usually goes completely up the left whenever they're going through something big, and I wish that was just a bit more normalized.
You're absolutely right. I wonder why you why that idea that as the baby gets older sleep will definitely be for longer periods, why is that idea still so prevalent when people have been having babies for a long time now? We think, where did this myth come from, and why is that still thought of as expected and the norm? I know certainly before my children were born, I went to see my next door neighbour who just had a baby, and it was a few weeks old. And I said, oh, you know, are you getting enough sleep? And she said, oh, he's doing brilliantly. He's sleeping for 5 hours at a time. And I thought at the time, oh, my God, that's awful. How on earth is she getting by with just 5 hours uninterrupted sleep? You know, me dedicated to my 8 hour chunk. And of course, now I know that was wonderful. And she was right to celebrate it and to feel pleased about that. I just wonder where these ideas come from about what normal infant sleep is and who's responsible for these lies.
I don't know. I want to round them up. I want to round them up and give them a bit of a slap. But I think part of it is that it does get better. So if you compare a newborn sleep pattern to, I don't know, perhaps a 9 or 10 week old, generally it will improve in that time. And so I think we often think that once things start improving, they're going to carry on improving, and we forget that there will be a blip or it'll go backwards. I think that there is a huge misinterpretation of that wretched term sleep regression, which I think also needs to go in the bin. And I think, you know, that's been a bit misunderstood over the years. I think that, again, what health professionals are taught holds a lot of weight for parents. So if a health professional is telling you, oh, well, they shouldn't need night feeds at 6 months and beyond, that tends to be thought of as more accurate as if your, you know, well-meaning friend says the same thing. That's partly it. I think also just in terms of general development, normally things carry on getting better and better, or we learn more and more skills. So you don't normally learn to roll, for example, and then just forget how to roll and have to start all over again. You don't normally learn words and then lose the ability to speak. And so I think for a lot of people, they just assume that sleep behaves in that same kind of developmental way, that once that milestone's been passed, it's like a one-way street. It's just going to keep getting better. And it's not true. That there was a lovely paper published at the end of last year that found that actually sleep just goes to pieces during developmental stages. And I was so glad they'd published it, because although it's a really obvious point, some of my favourite studies are the ones that state the bleeding obvious, because they finally give us the science and the evidence base for something that we've known for ages anyway, but now we've got some backup, which is nice.
And for the new mums listening to this, you know, they might be there at home with their little newborns in their arms. At what kind of stages would they maybe need to be aware that there's going to be a kind of two-step back experience with the sleep that ties in with baby developmental peaks, if you like? What do they want to be kind of having on their radar to reframe, you know, what's normal and what's to be expected?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I always try and shy away from putting a specific age on it, because I think that's how that phrase sleep regression came about in the first place. I think somebody, you know, tried to pin it down to an approximate age. And that's why it's now treated as kind of the gospel truth. So I always try and avoid that, if I'm honest. I would rather say, look, any time your little one is learning something big, and you'll know what that is. So it might be that they seem really frustrated when you put them on their back. They're desperately trying to, you know, move themselves to their side. They're obviously trying to roll onto their tummies, or they're obviously developing hand-eye coordination. They're trying to grab that little dangling toy above them or whatever. Or they're, I don't know, they're desperate to crawl. Any single time your little one is going through a big developmental stage like that, sleep's probably going to go up the left. And then you add into that things like being ill, going through a big change at home, like moving house or starting childcare. You chuck in starting solids or, you know, getting a new tooth. Literally, it can be endless, because yes, developmental stages can be fairly predictable. They tend to roll from back to front at about 3 to 4 months. They tend to roll from front to back at about 5 to 6 months. They tend to start learning to crawl at about 7 to 9 months. They tend to start learning to walk about 12 months, etc., etc. But A, there's a bit of variability within that, and B, that doesn't include all the things that are a bit more unpredictable, like illness.
So it's about looking at your baby and responding to your baby and kind of knowing those things are there as a kind of outside framework, but not being too attached to it.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I would say. Just accept that actually if there's something going on with your little one, sleep's probably going to be collateral damage, and to not panic about it. It'll come good. I promise.
Yeah, that's such good advice. I think the thing I see with the mums in the classes, and I'm sure we all remember that, is when you're in one of those moments, those phases, and you feel like you've taken the two-step backwards, you literally feel like this is what it's going to be like forever.
Yes.
You can't see the change that's going to move you forward again. And it's really hard when you're a mum in that, you know, feeling a bit sleep deprived, to know that it will change. This too shall pass. Yes. You know, we will come out of this.
Definitely. And I think that's exactly right. My husband always had to remind me that when we were kind of in a trench phase, that this had happened before, and I'm quite a catastrophizing sort of person. So I always assume that if I'm having a bad day, that's it, we're stuck. You know, life as we know it is gone, it's over. I'm quite a glass empty sort of person. And I lose perspective, and I see this with a lot of families as well. I was supporting a family not that long ago. I'm no longer seeing clients, but I was just finishing up with a client, and they'd had no stretches longer than an hour and a half for their child's entire, 10 months at that point. And we made some really, really simple changes around a later bedtime and fiddling around with the naps and just focusing on self-care, really, really not rocket science stuff. And he'd started having sort of 4 or 5 hour chunks of sleep every single night. So, you know, he'd probably had 10 nights of sleeping somewhere between 4 and 6 hours, maybe 5 out of 7 nights. And then they'd had 2 terrible nights. And we spoke again. And looking at the big changes that had happened, you know, looking on a macro level over the last week, it looked amazing. But of course, they were focusing on the dreadful night last night. And that's so common, because when you've had a bad night's sleep, everything feels awful. You can't see the progress on a macro level. You're focusing on, well, I feel wrecked right now. I feel like I'm going to die of lack of sleep today. And therefore, I've lost that hope and that optimism and that perspective. Does that make sense?
Completely makes sense. We need some little flashcards for mums to put around their room and around their house, just like, you know, encouraging them on the positive.
Yeah.
I sometimes, with my children, we sometimes have difficulty around transitions and moving from one place to another. And one of the tricks I was taught was to actually get a video of them while they're in the place that they love, having a good time, and then showing it to them before we're then making that transition, so that they can say, look, this is what it's going to be like when you get there. It is going to be better. I sometimes think people should do a little recording of themselves, like, we've just got through a horrendous thing, but we are sleeping again. Life is okay again. I can breathe. Things are all right. And like, then just keep that little recording for when the next time it's happening, because it does happen again. Like you said, it sometimes feels like a cycle of good or bad, or, you know, this too shall pass, and that's for the good and for the bad. Little reminder that it will be okay again, because like you said, I don't think you do have that memory. It very much feels like it's never going to change when you're in those spots. But the good news is, I think when you're in the good spot, you forget how bad it is as well very, very quickly. Which can be helpful. You were speaking before about how you want to bin the phrase drowsy but awake, and I completely agree with you. I think it's some rare unicorn babies do this magical thing where you just pop them down and, oh look, they just fall asleep independently. in terms of getting into good habits, that's sold as a good habit or something people should do sort of from the beginning to encourage this long independent sleep. What would you like to replace it with? Or is there anything that people can do to perhaps set themselves up for longer periods of sleep, or perhaps any good sleep hygiene recommendations for people about to have a baby or maybe right in the early days?
Oh goodness, there's a lot of things that I could talk about there, but I think in terms of keeping it real and practical, I would say that, you know, the way you're parenting your little one to sleep is probably the easiest, quickest, most reliable way of getting them to fall asleep, and therefore pathologizing that and saying that that's a bad habit is just completely illogical. Because if there was a really easy way of getting your child to go to sleep without any support from you, you'd probably have done it already. Parents aren't stupid. They don't end up rocking or feeding or cuddling their babies to sleep because they've gone straight to that and they've thought, oh well, everyone says the best thing to do is put my baby down drowsy but awake, so I'm just going to ignore that and I'm going to do this much more labor intensive high maintenance thing because that feels like a good idea. Of course parents, they're not stupid. That the reason they end up rocking and feeding and holding their babies to sleep is because that's the thing that works. It's just as simple as that. And so I think, you know, I would say if it's working for your baby and you right now, then it's working, period. And if at some point it's not working for you, if you feel touched out, if you do want to stop breastfeeding, if you, I don't know, if you want to have a night out, well, then you can deal with that then. But I think worrying about something that's working right now, thinking that it's going to set you up for this lifetime of nightmarish sleep, is just going to steal your joy. And it's the one thing that I wish I hadn't bothered feeling guilty about is, you know, trying to make my children sleep in a way that was actually, on reflection, completely impossible for them. I wish I'd just... it wouldn't have changed what I did, but it would have changed how I felt about it. I would have felt a lot more empowered and positive about the way that I was parenting my littles to sleep. It's just mm-hmm. normal parenting. So I would definitely say that if it's working, then it's working. End of.
Basically, keep calm and carry on. Yeah. And if it's don't worry about the future, don't steal your joy from now by worrying about things that may or may not happen. There's always opportunities to change in the future. I mean, rod for your own back is one of those fabulous phrases that I'd like to stick in the bin.
That needs to go in the bin. I think the other thing on a really practical level is to know what's normal in terms of total sleep times, because for so many families I've worked with, that's been a game changer. You know, accepting that actually, the books that recommend 12 hours sleep a night and a 2 hour nap and two shorter naps in the day, they're just on cloud cuckoo land. It's not evidence based. It's not real world data. They're making it up. It's based on, you know, strict non-responsive sleep training. And we know that a lot of the babies on those schedules will be just lying there quietly. They're not actually asleep at all. They're just not. They're not, you know, making a noise. Of course, there are some children who do have higher sleep needs and they will be sleeping 12 hours a night. I'm not, you know, if there's anyone listening going, well, I haven't sleep trained my baby and they have a 2 hour nap at lunchtime, I'm not accusing you of being non-responsive, because some little ones are like that. But the vast majority are not. The vast majority of children under the age of two only need up to about 11 hours absolute maximum overnight, and that is obviously not going to be consolidated. It'll be with wake-ups for all sorts of things, wet beds, feeds, nightmares, you know, you name it. So 11 hours overnight sleep, and you know, when parents are aware of how much sleep is normal in 24 hours, they stop worrying about things like, you know, overtiredness, which is really overdiagnosed. And, you know, that if they don't get those naps, those long naps in the day, that sleep's going to go to pieces at night, all of those things that people worry about. And it's impossible to make children sleep more than they actually need to sleep. So if your little one's having 3 half-hour naps in the day and then 11 hours of broken sleep at night, and they're completely fine, the chances are that if you try and get them to have a longer nap in the hope that it'll make your night less fragmented, you're just going to end up getting really stressed out, because they probably won't be able to have a longer nap than that if they don't need it.
That makes so much sense, doesn't it? It's just kind of how we are as humans. I'm going to go to sleep when I'm tired, and as much rocking or whatever you could do with me, it's not going to work if I'm not actually tired. So
the scenario that I have run into, you know, hundreds of times is, you know, a parent who's worried that the reason their baby isn't sleeping for a long stretch at night is because they're overtired and they're not getting enough sleep. Those parents tend to expend vast amounts of energy trying to extend naps or make naps happen at times that books or apps or, you know, charts say they should be napping. And what ends up happening is that a child who's not tired will not go to sleep. So they will, you know, in inverted commas, then fight or refuse sleep, which then makes parents stressed out and frustrated and panicked, which, you know, raises their stress levels, which dysregulates the little one. And then we end up in this dysregulated, hot, sweaty, tearful, demoralized mess. And we've still not got any more sleep, but we're now just feeling underconfident with our parenting. And we feel like, well, we're clearly sucking at parenting here because we can't get this child to go to sleep. And actually, if we just knew that the sleep they're getting is normal and adequate, then we'd let it go and we'd just go and get on with the day.
There wouldn't be a problem that needed fixing with an imaginary solution that just causes more trouble.
And as you were saying before about co-regulation, that's, you know, if they're really stressed and anxious and they try to go to sleep, it's going to have the opposite effect, isn't it, really? And I know we've all had that thing where you feel so desperate for something, and it is like those times where you're the most desperate is absolutely not happening. And it's because you're desperate, you know. It's definitely a cycle related. Do you see any correlations in your work between people who have had traumatic births or perhaps a difficult start and sleep issues?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a number of problems that I see. One is hypervigilance at night. So a real difficulty with letting other people help. That's a significant problem. And actually, it's one that I can relate to. I had two fairly grim pregnancies and births. I was quite unwell. And I remember as well not being able to let anyone help me. I wouldn't let anybody take my babies and hold my babies, even though I was desperate for a break and some sleep. I couldn't let go of that responsibility. I was terrified that they would miss her feeding cues, or that they would mess it up, or that they would leave her to cry. I just couldn't switch off. And even when people I loved and trusted would come over and say, oh, I'll, you know what, I don't think you'll be able to sleep unless we actually leave the house. So then they would take her for a walk in the pushchair and say, well, look, have a sleep while I'm out. And I couldn't. I was just lying there wide awake going, oh, but what if she needs a feed and they don't bring her back? Or what if they decide, oh, actually, what I'll do is I'll give Lindsay an even longer break, because, you know, it just made me so stressed out. And I've seen that time and time again playing out. And the research evidence backs that up as well. So taking a baby away from somebody who's got mental health problems or trauma or, anxiety for something, it might be pregnancy related, or it might just be an ongoing long-standing anxiety, is probably not going to work. The other thing I see is insomnia. So it's not necessarily always the fact that the baby is waking in the night that's the problem. It's the fact that the parent can't return to sleep once they've been woken. So let's take an example of a baby waking a completely normal amount of times, perhaps a six-month-old, you know, perhaps waking three times in the night, completely normal. But actually, if it takes you an hour to return to sleep after that brief feed or that brief resettle, then you've lost 3 hours of sleep. So actually, you might be going from a situation where you've had perhaps 6 or 7 hours of broken sleep to perhaps just 3 hours of broken sleep. And all of a sudden, that's really significant sleep deprivation. Most people can actually cope with 6, 7 hours of broken sleep. That's manageable. 3 hours, that's not sustainable. So that's a big problem, actually. So I would say there are two main things. One is the, you know, finding it difficult to go back to sleep. And the other one is that difficulty allowing people in, you know, even allowing perhaps a partner to have a chance of settling a little one. That's really, really common. You know, really, really dedicated, invested co-parents, either the bonus mum or the bonus dad or the father of that child, you know, genuinely desperate to help, longing to help, offering to help, but actually not being able to let them have a try and kind of stepping in really quickly and saying, oh, it's not working. Give the baby back to me and I'll do it.
When you look back now, can the Lindsay now, how would you support the Lindsay then who was really struggling with that? You know, what do you think? Because I think this is something I've heard many, many times before. And it feels like, well, how do people help? How can they support the mum? And we know that mothering the mother is so needed and not generally done by our society anyway. Can you think of any sort of practical tips, or did you have any particular maybe therapies that helped you or things that soothed you during this time? How did it change for you?
One thing that would definitely help would be earlier and better identification of mental health problems and trauma, better management of birth trauma. For me, it was not just birth trauma. It was, you know, we'd lost a lot of babies. It was quite a traumatic pregnancy. So there were sort of layers of trauma. And I don't think that's ever really been, it was not unpicked, certainly by my health professionals. I've, you know, subsequently gone on to deal with that by myself, but I think it would be, you know, wonderful if that was better managed within the NHS. And I think the other thing is actually a better recognition that this stuff is really, really hard. It's really normal to find it hard. And just empowering parents to know that actually, even if they are health professionals, even if they, you know, have worked in the industry for a long time, it's still really hard, and they're not screwing up because they're finding it hard. I think I wish people would understand that just because something's hard doesn't mean they're getting it wrong. It's actually often because they're getting it right. So I think that would help as well. But yeah, we need to bring back the village, don't we? Which I know is a really easy thing to say and not an easy thing to make happen. And, you know, certainly not everybody has access to lots of support. I didn't. But I think online villages are a really positive thing as well. And I think we can tap into that a lot more than we do.
Lots of babies who have difficulty sleeping independently suffer from health issues such as reflux and CMPA. And these things seem to be being diagnosed a lot more frequently nowadays as well. What would you say to families who are struggling with these kinds of issues?
Well, I think there's a lot of self-diagnosis going on that makes me worried. And there's a lot of diagnosis from people who are perhaps not health professionals and also not lactation professionals either. That worries me. I think that these diagnoses are serious diagnoses and need to be managed by the most appropriately qualified professional. So I would always, always urge people to work with their medical practitioner alongside a feeding specialist. My go-to guru here is Shell Banks, who's an IBCLC and infant feeding specialist. and she's really the pretty much the only specialist that I recommend in the whole area of, you know, reflux, unsettled babies, colic, cow's milk protein allergy, lactose intolerance, all of those things. I think it's really dangerous to go down the Google black hole at 2 o'clock in the morning and Google things like reflux, spit up, green poo, whatever, because in amongst the millions of hits that you're going to get, there might be only one or two really decent ones. And probably the first page of Google is going to be a bunch of sponsored ads and industry funded stuff and, you know, non-evidence based blogs. So I don't know, the internet is like the Wild West, isn't it? And it's, I feel so, so desperately sorry for parents who are just trying to look for answers for their unhappy baby, or the fact that actually parenting is not much fun because we're dealing with, you know, lots of vomit or lots of unhappiness and all of that stuff. And yeah, of course they're looking for answers, you know, any parent would, wouldn't they? But the internet can be a dangerous place because it's difficult to know which sources are credible and which ones just look really shiny.
Yeah. Do you think it's one of those things where if it is correctly diagnosed and assessed and medication, if needed, is given in a timely manner, it really should make a big difference to how babies are sleeping? Or do you think there's just so many interweaving issues involved, it's not as simple as go and get some Gaviscon or go and get some omeprazole or whatever and suddenly your baby will sleep?
Yeah, I mean, I think getting the right diagnosis is important because, you know, a lot of problems have overlapping symptoms. So, you know, a lot of symptoms of tongue tie might have overlap with reflux. A lot of the time, though, there's an awful lot of misunderstanding of normal infant behavior that gets mixed in with this as well. So, for example, you know, perhaps overthinking the baby who doesn't want to be put down on their back in their Moses basket, for example, that's not necessarily a symptom of reflux. That's a symptom of a baby who is, you know, in the fourth trimester and just wants to be held. Or, you know, spitting up after feeds, or sometimes being fussy, or cluster feeding, or frequently feeding, or whatever. All of those are just symptoms of being a baby. They're not symptoms of anything particularly special. I think the right diagnosis is important. If there is a medical problem, and as a pediatric nurse who has worked with some babies with incredibly severe reflux, I really strongly dispute the idea that's out there that if you get to the underlying cause of the reflux, whether that's allergy or, you know, whatever, that you're going to eliminate. No, you won't. A small proportion of children do have extremely severe reflux requiring surgery. And I think it does them a disservice to say that there's always an underlying cause which we can find and manage with dietary strategies. That's not true. That's why it's so important to have the right people involved so that, you know, we can get families the right support, whether that's, you know, normalizing infant behavior, whether that's feeding support, whether that's medication, whether that's mental health support. It's usually a combination of all of that, to be perfectly honest.
Absolutely. You talk in your book very honestly about bed sharing. You sort of suggest that it's not a one size fits all approach. And you talk about the benefits and the negatives, as well as giving really good information with regards to safety. And lots of parents do end up bed sharing, often through exhaustion and when their baby won't settle by themselves. And some parents choose to, right from the beginning, bring their baby into their bed because that's what feels right for them and their families. Do you have any information about bed sharing that you would like people to know?
Yeah, I mean, I think our support and language around bed sharing has changed significantly in the last few years. Certainly when I was a health visitor, even then, that we're going back, you know, 10 years, you know, even then I was saying to people, look, it's not about telling you not to bed share. It's about giving you support and information so that you can make an informed choice about whether bed sharing is right. Because unlike the USA, we don't make a blanket prohibition of bed sharing in this country, because we know that when you do that, when you say that something is taboo, people will do it anyway, because let's face it, bed sharing is sometimes just the only thing that helps people get through the night. But if they think it's sort of not allowed or, you know, frowned upon, they just won't be honest about it. And that's when that denies us the opportunity to have honest and sensible conversations about how to make it as safe as possible. And with the problem with SIDS is that we're never talking about making anything safe. We're talking about making it safer. So our language is incredibly important. And I think that we just need to enable parents to feel comfortable to share what it is that they're doing. What we don't want to see, of course, is people falling asleep on sofas. And certainly, again, going back many years, I remember having conversations with parents where they would say things like, oh, I know bed sharing's really naughty and I know I'm not supposed to do it, even though I hadn't said that to them. But that was their perception of what I, the health professional, was going to say, and I was going to waggle my finger at them. So they would say, I know I'm not supposed to do it, so I've been sitting upright on the sofa, but the problem is I end up falling asleep on the sofa. And of course, that's exactly the kind of conversation we want to have with parents, so that we can say, well, did you know that actually if you're that tired and you're likely to fall asleep while holding or feeding your baby, it's much safer for you to be lying down on a flat surface in your bed. And, you know, let's go and see how we can make it as safe as we possibly can. But it requires an individual chat as well, because there are some families where bed sharing is inappropriate. You know, if you're on sedating antihistamines or you're on, you know, very, very strong painkillers that make you drowsy, it's probably not a great idea. If you've had, you know, 3 glasses of wine, it's probably not a good idea. If your baby was born prematurely, it's at the moment not felt to be a good idea, even though that's really difficult. And even though I've had lots of conversations with parents of preterm babies who say, yes, but now they're, you know, they're chunky and they're 8 months old and they're 6 months corrected. Is it okay now? And of course, the really difficult but honest answer is we don't have enough data, so we have to say no for now, which is really difficult. But that's why we need to have these honest conversations, so that we can say, well, okay, what is difficult? How can we make it a little bit easier? So could we think about a co-sleeper crib, or could we think about, you know, perhaps bed sharing for a nap when you've got another parent around observing or whatever. But it's very difficult to make a blanket statement about what's right for everyone, because, well, everyone's going to have their own individual circumstances.
When also, just by giving them the information, you're then leaving the choice and responsibility up to them, which is as it should be. Each parent can make those choices that's right for them, and with the information, with the correct information, which is so important. One of the hot topics is night weaning. A lot of breastfeeding parents end up bed sharing with their babies because it's the quickest, easiest way for everyone to get the most amount of sleep. And then often there becomes a point where perhaps they're getting touched out, perhaps baby really is waking very frequently in order to feed. And they feel like they've had enough and the time has come for them to start getting perhaps their bed back to themselves a little bit more, that time back to themselves. Is this an area you often support families with?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm often asked, when is it okay to night wean? And it's a really difficult question, because there's a, when is it in the literature, you know, common for children to spontaneously stop feeding at night? That's one conversation. And then the other one, which is on a completely individual and personal level, is when is it right for you? And what are the situations and contextual circumstances that you're in that mean that you're considering it? And they are different conversations, because of course it's appropriate to support somebody at any stage of their breastfeeding journey to stop breastfeeding with, you know, kindness and compassion and understanding. And, you know, I've supported families with a whole range of different reasons why they need to stop breastfeeding, from the highly emotive, you know, I literally need to start chemotherapy type of situation, all the way through till I'm actually just done. I'm touched out. I've actually had enough and I'm no longer enjoying it. And they're both meaningful in different ways. And I think, you know, although the literature says that, you know, night feeding is normal until at least 18 months. So if I'm going to give a generic response about when night weaning is, you know, a reasonable thing to try, certainly it's easier once they've got a little bit of language, certainly in terms of looking at those massive population level studies that look at when it's normal for children to stop feeding, we're talking about 18 months. In terms of an individual response, it's whenever that individual family decides, I'm done. And sometimes just getting some balance back, putting some limits in play, means that families feel enabled to continue for longer. So if a baby is, you know, waking every hour all night long, and a family says to me, honestly, I've had it, I want to walk out, I want to check into the travel lodge for 3 nights and just let someone else deal with this, at that point, sometimes saying, okay, well, of course you can. However, how would you feel about putting some limits in place just so that you can get some balance back? Because sometimes when they do that, they decide, actually, I don't really want to stop completely. The thought of that makes me feel really sad, but I just don't want to feed every hour. And that's okay. That's really okay. And it's always a balance, isn't it, between the child's needs for responsiveness and emotional support with something that's difficult, and also the parent's needs. But the one thing I would say is that stopping breastfeeding or even bottle feeding at night, first of all, will probably mean less sleep in the short term. Because, so, you know, if you decide you're going to rock and hold your baby to sleep instead of feed them, chances are it's going to take longer and it's going to be more hard work. There'll probably be some crying involved, which is obviously going to mean that you're going to get even less sleep. Now, not all parents have got capacity for getting even less sleep than they are right now. And a lot of them are sold this idea that if you stop feeding to sleep or you stop feeding in the night, it's going to spontaneously improve nighttime sleep. And what they need to know is actually that's not always the case, so that they can make an informed choice about that. But also that it's going to lead to probably quite significant sleep deprivation in the very short term as well. So there's two things. It's going to make you knackered tonight and for the next few nights. And it also might not improve the night waking, because kids need us in the night. If you stop one form of support, which might be feeding, you might need to just give them another form of support, only it might just take you longer. And that sounds kind of depressing, but it's just about informed choice. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't night wean. It just means that you need to go into it eyes wide open and say, okay, well, in that case, that's where I need, you know, somebody else to step up and, you know, help out. If I'm not going to be feeding in the night, then how are we going to provide this child with the support that they might need in the night? So that might be, well, you can do half the night then, to a partner or a, you know, trusted family member or friend or doula or whoever.
I think it would be really interesting if you could speak a little bit, Lindsay, about that awful phrase that we also probably want to put in the bin, controlled crying, that I still hear about today when people are kind of so tired and they're just like, we're just thinking about trying a bit of controlled crying. It's not like how it used to be. We do go in more.
Yes, I'm always really happy to talk about controlled crying. I think we need to be honest with families so that they can make an informed choice about it. I'm for parents. I don't hate people who sleep train. You know, I think often people head for controlled crying because they can't see another way out. They're so tired, they're desperate for sleep. And this is why actually I have a problem with the sort of people who say, oh, well, just bed share and, you know, feed on demand. This too shall pass. You know, wait it out. It'll be fine. I think the problem with that, with no other solutions offered at all, is that people sometimes feel like, well, the only other solution then is control crying or cry it out.
They feel quite polarised, actually, don't they? It's kind of this or that, and where's the strategies in the middle?
Yeah, there are lots, and you know, you don't necessarily have to buy my books to find them. I make no real secret of them. They're all over my Instagram, but there are lots and lots and lots of things that you could do that are, you know, miles away from either of those polar extremes. But in terms of how I would speak to that idea of controlled crying, I've spoken about this in Still Awake, actually, my latest book, and I don't know that anyone else talks about it in this way, but I think there are three groups of children with sleep training. So sort of non-responsive approaches, walking away, leaving them to cry for a prescribed amount of time and then coming back again. I think we've got the sort of the responders to sleep training. So those are the little ones where you speak to families and they describe, you know, perhaps, you know, 20 minutes of stop, start crying the first night, hardly any crying the second night, and no crying at all by the third night. I think there are babies out there that are like that. And I think those parents tend to be quite evangelical about sleep training because it isn't that painful. You know, if we think about grand scheme of things, you know, 20 minutes of stop, start crying and job done. I can understand why people extol the virtues of that, right? In the context of, you know, mental health and, you know, extreme fatigue and all of that stuff, I get it. So I think there are the responders. Then I think there are the slow responders. So these are the children who they cry a lot more and they cry a lot louder and they might cry for a few more days as well. But they do get there. So they might eventually sleep. It might take more like 5 or 6 days. It might be quite intense. You know, families might describe, you know, 3 nights of really quite a lot of crying before their child eventually seems to start sleeping. But then I think there are also the non-responders. And these are the children where the control crying is going on and on and on. And we're into week 2. Or week 3, or dare I say it, I've heard of people doing this for 6 weeks and it is not working. Their child is still crying. It's still taking hours to settle. They're still waking up and crying in the middle of the night. And it's really the non-responders that I am most concerned about, because I think, you know, 1 or 2 nights of less responsive parenting, I don't think that's going to damage children in the context of a securely, you know, attached relationship and, you know, a responsive home with lots of, you know, support and emotional containment the rest of the day. I just, kids are more resilient than that. 1 or 2 nights is really not going to make a big difference. But it's the kiddies where they just don't seem to respond that worry me, because these children, I've had so many parents contact me saying, I've been doing this now for a while. It's not really working. And now my child seems withdrawn. They're not smiling in the day. They're not playing with me. They don't seem to want to, you know, engage with me in the same way. And I think we need to be honest about that as well. The reason I don't use controlled crying at all is because I don't know whether the child I've got in front of me is going to be a responder, a slow responder, or a non-responder. I just don't know. So for me, it's not worth the risk. But also, the parents that want support often are not interested. And I think we need to be honest that actually if parents are looking for a strategy that doesn't make them feel awful, because let's face it, control crying is stressful for parents as well as for babies, then, you know, it's clearly not appropriate to be selling control crying as this brilliant solution if a parent's actually really uncomfortable with the idea of their little one crying and them not being able to respond in the way they normally would during the daytime.
It makes perfect sense. And just to drill a little bit deeper, the kind of emotional response then that the parents are having from the babies that are non-responders, you know, 4 weeks in, 6 weeks in, where the babies are now unhappy and not smiling at mum. Can you speak a little bit about what's happened to that non-responder? What's the stress response that's gone on? What's the hormones that are in their little systems? Has that changed something developmentally? You know, what are those bigger issues that underlie this whole discussion?
Yeah, so this is the really difficult part, because we do there aren't many studies that have looked at this, and I do try to, you know, be able to back up what I say with evidence as much as I can. We've got some not very good studies that have not found any harm with controlled crying, but there are a lot of problems with those studies, which I won't bore you with today. I've blogged about them. And then we also have one study that specifically found that when little ones were left to cry, their cortisol levels were really high, as you would expect when you're crying, because it causes a stress response. But the interesting thing about that study was, even after those little ones had gone to sleep, they rechecked their cortisol levels and found that the cortisol was still high, even though they were now fast asleep. And that was the Middlemiss study. That's, you know, we have to be honest about that, that we do have some evidence that actually little ones haven't, you know, in inverted commas, self-soothed at all. They've just stopped signalling. They've stopped outwardly signalling that they're unhappy and they're needing that co-regulation from their parent. And actually the study was about something called asynchrony. So it was actually about the asynchrony of the parent-infant response. And what, interestingly, you know, parents and infants are normally in sync in terms of their stress response. That's that co-regulation, that emotional contagion that we were talking about before. So if you've got a stressed infant, you've normally got a stressed parent, because that's normal. But in this study, what they found was, once the babies were asleep and no longer outwardly signaling that they were distressed, the parent's stress response went away. So the parent was now calm and the baby was still actually stressed. This is important because actually parents are required to do something called a tune to their babies. That's what helps them to become securely attached. So we know that actually when we are kind of given those outward or, you know, body language cues that little ones are upset, that will help us to modify our behavior so that we can appropriately, you know, attune to our littles and do something to take the stress away for them. If we're not aware that they're stressed, we can't do that. That's the problem. So it's that asynchrony of the response that we're concerned about.
That's really interesting. It kind of brings to mind those sort of situations that you sometimes see when you're out and about, where there's a little one distressed, crying, maybe they've fallen over, maybe they're tired and they're having a moment, and what they really need is for their big person to come down to their level, give them a big hug, reassure them and soothe with them. And it really hurts my heart when I see an opposite response, where that parent's been triggered and they haven't got any more capacity for compassion. And they respond in a kind of angry, stop crying, da, 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 you know, and they retaliate rather than come from a place of compassion. And it just really breaks my heart, because it's just compounding that, isn't it?
And yet, I think we've all probably had those moments. I think it's a really normal part when we ourselves need filling up. You know, you can't pour from an empty cup. And we see those people out there, and we've been those people out there, perhaps, you know, rather than feeling like you're being judged for not being your best in that moment, which is the worst feeling, actually lending some support to that parent and saying, you're struggling, they're struggling, this is a hard scenario, no one's winning here, sending them a little smile, offering to help them with their shopping, whatever it is, it's an opportunity there for our own kindness and compassion to support the family. And I think if we lived in a village or whatever, and you knew the name of the person that was struggling, you'd go up to them, you'd say, oh, Donna, you're having a rubbish day, aren't you? And look, little Effie's really kicking off here. Can I, you know, what can I do? Can I make you a cup of tea? You know, and we don't have that. So instead, you feel like you're all alone in the world, surrounded by eyes judging you. And that's not helpful. I wish there was like a secret signal or something you could give someone to say, I know, it's okay, I get it, we're all behind you here.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's always, you know, it's sort of Sod's law, isn't it, that, you know, people are going to witness your most your lowest point, right? So it's gonna, I remember I was walking the dogs with the kids and it was pouring with rain because it's Devon and it always pours with rain. And we're in the middle of Dartmoor, right? In the middle of nowhere. And both the children were being bratty. And I had, you know, that moment, because none of us, of course, is perfect. We don't get it right all the time, do we? But of course, just as I shouted at the children and said, oh, for goodness sake, we just need to get this dog walk done and then we can go home and have a hot chocolate. But if you don't stop belly aching, you know, honestly, it's just going to ruin everyone's day. And I was really angry. And of course, at that moment, you know, somebody, some old busybody came along and went, oh, I remember those days. You'll miss them when they're go-. And I was just like, oh, for goodness sake, you haven't seen all of the moments when I've been on it and I've been, you know, meeting their needs. You saw, of course, my low point, didn't you? And of course, that's going to happen in Tesco, isn't it? When, you know, it all kicks off and you just feel all the eyes going, well, you just need to feed that baby, or you just need to, why did you come shopping when your child's obviously, you know, of course, everyone else has got the answers, haven't they? But you're right. I think we do just need to just throw those parents a smile. It's hard behind masks, isn't it? But, you know, we could just do a little kind of hand signal or something just to let them know that we've been there. And I think if you're that parent, you know, you're not going to get it right. They reckon 50% getting it right, getting it, you know, enough right is enough for kiddies. That's what good enough parenting is all about. We don't need to nail it all the time.
Absolutely. I love that meme that goes around with the, you know, parent in 2021 needs to meet the emotional, physical, sensory needs of their child, needs to make sure they're getting enough activity but enough downtime, needs to make sure they're getting 3 balanced meals, and then all this whole list of things that we all take into account. And then on the other side, you know, parent in 1950s, feed child sometimes. And it's like and sometimes that is a little bit comforting when you think of perhaps the tools that maybe our parents might have used or our grandparents might have used, putting them in the buggy at the bottom of the garden, leaving them outside Woolworths, getting away home and then remembering that there was a child there. True story. So perhaps having a cross moment in a day full of where you've been patient and compassionate. Oh, come on, let's give ourselves a break. We're human. And we need our children to know that they're big, you know, we all have these big feelings. Yeah. Them in our house. We're allowed to have them. We're allowed to get it wrong. And then it's what we do afterwards. It's still a lesson in parenting. Absolutely. Isn't it? It's a lesson that our kids need to know. Speaking of older children, and we haven't had time to talk as much about your new book, but I was really keen. I've got loads of questions I want to ask you. Maybe another podcast another time. But just a quick one for parents of children who are 3, 5, 7, 9, 12, and they are still struggling with sleep issues. And this is a lot more common than I think people often realize. They often blame themselves. And do you think that's fair? What would you say to those parents?
No, I mean, I think we've talked before about sleep being, you know, developmental, and that means it's not necessarily linear. There are going to be blips along the way, and I think sleep is often a symptom. You know, when they're little, babies don't sleep because babies don't sleep, and they need feeding, they need co-regulating, all sorts of things. But actually, older children also need co-regulating, and their sleep can be affected by a billion other things that, you know, as children get bigger, their problems kind of get bigger. You know, between us, we've got, you know, a range of aged children, and you know yourself that, you know, when they're 2, it's a broken banana or a, you know, a sandwich cut in the wrong shape. But as they get older, it's their bigger problems. They're not more significant, because that's just about life experience, isn't it? But they are perhaps problems that take more rationalizing or more unpacking or more emotional regulation and understanding. So that's where we need to think about, you know, anxiety and about self-esteem and children's confidence and their peers and so many things, that communication, exercise. So that's why there's a whole book on just the older kids age group, because there's so much to say that is different from the way we manage sleep in infancy.
So perhaps instead of beating themselves up for letting their kid watch a bit of TV before going to bed, maybe they can think, this is an opportunity for connection. Maybe this is a time where that need, because it's bedtime, the needs don't stop, do they? And I think that, you know, you don't stop being a parent just because it's past 7 o'clock. So finding a way to connect and tune in with your child, that's going to be beneficial for you as well. I mean, that's sometimes those most rewarding, special moments as a parent, is where you overcome a difficulty together, or you watch your child resolve their own problem, but you get to be witness to it. And so perhaps focusing on the sleep hygiene or what's going on in their bedroom might not necessarily be helpful in a lot of cases. It might be, let's talk. What's going on?
It might be something else. It might be something that they've been ruminating about that happened in the playground or at nursery, or, you know, it could be anything. I love working with older children because actually it's more interesting in lots of ways. There's a lot more things that can impact sleep, but that's really cool because actually that means there are a lot more ways that we can support children with their sleep. We don't just have to make it all about the sleep. Sometimes I do nothing with sleep. We literally just work on self-esteem and growth mindset and relationships and, you know, helping kids develop strategies to calm down or for self-care or whatever it is, whatever. So many things that you can do with older kiddies. It's really fun, honest.
Do you see the co-regulation play out? So when the parents have got older kiddies and there's stuff going on for the parents, maybe the kids aren't even consciously aware of it, but do you still see how they maybe subconsciously pick up on that and the co-regulation still occurs?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think children often know more than we think they know. And we need to remember that. We need to be honest with children, because often if we don't answer their questions honestly, or if we don't volunteer information openly, they will invent or imagine a much worse reality than that which is actually true. I used to see that a lot with nursing sick children. We needed to listen to those children when they were saying things like, am I going to die? Rather than just assume that children won't have those fears or that they're not actually thinking that deep down, we need to actually make space to allow them to have those really big frightening thoughts so that we can do something about it. But yes, children are also very susceptible to picking up on relationship tensions and, you know, our own worries and stresses.
So, Lindsay, there are three questions we like to ask all of our guests. One is, we offer the statement, I'm a yoga teacher, but, and it's our chance to dispel any myths or maybe ideas about what it means to be a yoga teacher.
I'm a very honest, real person. So there's far too many things that I could share with you with this. One of the funny ones, I think, is I'm a lactation consultant, but I hate milk. I really, really, really hate milk. I don't mind working with human milk, but if my kids or husband has a glass of milk, I literally can't watch. It makes me feel physically sick. I really, really hate it. So that's kind of funny because I work with milk a lot, obviously.
Do you think humans should drink human milk and cows should drink cow milk?
So if you offered me a glass of human milk, I still wouldn't want to drink it. I have no problem supporting parents to feed their babies or their toddlers or their older children milk. That's absolutely fine. But for some reason, once it's in a glass and it's I just can't cope with it. It really makes me feel unwell. And the other one is we actually touched on it before you hit record, but that is that I'm a responsive parenting advocate, and I actually really, really enjoy time away from my kids. I really, really value time on my own. I love it when they go to school. I love it when they've got a play date and they're busy. I'm really happy to give everything I have to my kids, but oh my goodness, I love time on my own.
Definitely. And it's good for others to hear that. I think there's a lot of one-upmanship on being a mummy martyr, and actually there's something quite refreshing to say, you know what, I got to sit down and read a magazine and it felt just wonderful, and I would kind of rather be doing that than making cereal or brushing hair for the fifth time in a week. Lovely. Thanks, Lindsay. That's brilliant. And what are you grateful for in your life right now?
I'm honestly grateful to be working for myself. I've worked for the NHS for a number of years and love it. I love the NHS. I'm still a registered nurse, but I absolutely love working for myself. I love not having bureaucracy. I love not having to do statutory and mandatory training, manual handling training and Caldecott guardian training and all of that stuff that is just really important but not particularly interesting to me. So I love that. I love being able to work to my own schedule. If I want to work between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. because that's when I'm feeling, you know, motivated and the ideas are flowing, I can do that, and it's great.
Well, thank you so much, Lindsay, for being with us today and sharing so much knowledge. I know so many people will have really benefited from the things that you've shared, and it's been fascinating for us to hear. We'll be making sure to put all of your information in our show notes so people can find you and get in touch with you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Lindsay.